Mary and Joseph According to the Popes, a talk by Peter Holmes at Eyewitness 2013.
I was asked to talk on Mary and Joseph, particularly as they're presented by the Popes, I think the last couple of Popes, and what their examples give us in terms of a way of living our life as men and women. This is right, well, at least I've interpreted it as right up my alley, because that's easier. Because my PhD is on masculinity, and of course you can't study masculinity without having a brief look at least at femininity, because those two are complementary opposites. Well, not so much opposites, but complementary. But Mary and Joseph, when I actually started to look into this, I thought, it's okay, I'll just cut and paste a page from my thesis on Joseph and that will be fine, except that when I pulled it out, yes, it did have all the references to the popes and all the Catholic teachings, and a surprising number of popes, almost every single one, has said something at least about St. Joseph and something about Mary. But frankly, it was, as most PhD theses are, boring. So I'm going to, mercifully, take half a dozen points about Mary, half a dozen points about Joseph, all of which, I assure you, are drawn directly from the Pope's teachings, but I'm not going to tell you all the footnotes. I'm just going to tell you what they are and try and reflect on them in terms of how they encourage us to live our life. Mary, probably, or she can go first, because ladies first. But she also should go first because, frankly, she's one of the, well, she's the only human being, barring Christ, who we'd call sinless. Imagine being, by the way, Joseph in that family. You've got Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. She's sinless. Jesus is completely without sin, obviously. So if something goes wrong, Joseph. So we'll come back to that and how he bore that. Mary is often called the prototypical Christian. In other words, she's the prototype, the example, the exemplar of what it is to be Christian. We might unpack why we say that about her as we go through. But what I wanted to do was take apart, just piece by piece, what we know about her, particularly from Scripture, and what the popes have worked on in terms of their drawing out of this theology. And it's surprising. Because the couple of things we always think about with Mary is firstly her submission to God. She says, let it be done to me according to your word. She gives herself over to God's will. The shorthand for this in Catholic theology is Mary's fiat. Now that doesn't mean she drove a car. It's fiat in Latin is let it be done. And it's the very short, it's typical of Latin. Fiat mihi, let it be done to me. Before she says this, however, before she says, let it be done, there is a few other lines exchanged. The angel appears and says, hail, full of grace. Now, what does that sound like? We've heard that before. Sounds like the Hail Mary, except we have another word in there. We say, hail Mary, full of grace. Now, the angel's talking to Mary. He doesn't need to say that. But he says, hail, full of grace. He actually says, in Greek, fully graced one. It's a verb. It says, hail one who is fully graced. You could not fit any more grace into Mary, this verb says. Then he says, the Lord is with you. Now, to understand Mary's reaction, we have in Luke's Gospel, which is where it appears, a kind of comparison. Zechariah, one of the priests, is standing in the temple. He has prayed for children. An angel of the Lord appears beside the altar and says to him, your prayers have been answered, Zechariah. Your wife is going to have a child. And he says, can you show me something that would prove this? I need some proof. And the angel says, you mean like an angel appearing in the temple? I'm an angel. I come directly from God to tell you what. And Zechariah gets in trouble. Only a small amount of trouble. Mary has not been praying for a child, as far as we know. It certainly wouldn't have been since she wasn't married. And when she's told she's about to have a child, She says, how is this going to happen? Because I don't know a man. No in the means I'm not at all with a man. She doesn't ask if it's going to happen or ask the angel to prove it's going to happen. She asks how. There's two things I want to say about that. Firstly, she doesn't doubt that it will. If God says so, it will. She just takes that. But she doesn't just go, whatever you say, I'm sorry, I'll just hide here in the corner. She says, how? She's intellectually engaged with the problem. Even when the angel greets her, the text says that she wondered, she was troubled, and she wondered what this greeting might be. When Zechariah is in the temple and he sees the angel, he's petrified. There's a different word in Greek. When Mary sees the angel, she's troubled, she's concerned, and she wonders, as the angel says, fully graced one, she goes, that's a strange way to greet someone. She thinks about it. She's actively engaged with her mind. It's only after she asks the question and the angel answers her question that she commits herself completely to God's plan. This is, in a few lines, a microcosm of how Mary not only teaches us how to be Christian, but specifically women, teaches us what submission actually means. Submission is not giving up my will to somebody else, but understanding at first what I'm giving up to, what I'm committing myself to, knowing what I'm doing. And when I know what I'm committing myself to, making that act of the will towards that thing. It's no good saying, oh, I'm going to be a Christian and follow Christ if we make no effort to know who Christ is and what that means to be a Christian. It's the same as one of the biggest problems with marriage today is that there's lots and lots of people standing up and saying, I do, and they have no idea what they've said, I do too. And they get to the end of it and they realize, I didn't know what I was doing. That's right, you didn't. If we're going to be Christians in general, but specifically ladies, if you're going to commit yourself to something, particularly in terms of submission, either to Jesus directly or to God through a husband, then you need to know what you're doing. You need to understand what it means. Mary's intellect is actively involved. She questions. And this is why at the end of Fides et Ratio, the Pope John Paul's encyclical on faith and reason, he has a whole section on Mary as Queen of Wisdom, on Mary as the one who leads us in discovering the truth. She doesn't switch off her brain. She actively engages it to understand God's will. When she understands it, she trusts completely and gives herself unreservedly to God. Second point. As we said, Zechariah doesn't really trust. He says, "How's it? I don't get it. You need to prove it to me." Mary commits herself utterly. In fact, she's so committed that when she talks to Elizabeth later, she's already praising God for having done it, for having won the salvation that he's promised. Just a really cool fact, by the way. Mary and Elizabeth meet, you know, the visitation? Mary and Elizabeth meet. Who's in Elizabeth's womb? John the Baptist. Who's in Mary's womb? Christ. These two women already playing out their son's mission. John the Baptist's role is to proclaim the coming of Christ, and Christ's role, obviously, is redemption. Elizabeth proclaims Christ in Mary's womb, and Mary declares the Magnificat, the glory and the salvation of God. Already, the women, the mothers, are engaged in the ministry of their sons, already in the womb. In carrying out these things, third point, Mary is pure. Now, this might seem like a given, and we often revere the purity of Mary, Mary most pure, immaculate, etc. But what does purity mean? It's not just abstaining from something, but it's abstaining from other things in order to be totally and completely committed to God. Anyone can not do stuff. I mean, sometimes it's hard not to do stuff, but anyone can do that. Abstinence, or not in abstinence in the technical sense, but remaining pure is not from things, but for something. Mary is pure for God. She remains completely and utterly focused on the mission and calling, the vocation that God has called her to. She doesn't seek worldly pleasures, reassurances to her self-esteem, self-serving sins. Mary's goal, total and only goal, is to love God, especially in the person of Christ who she bears. Interestingly enough, Mary, who has submitted herself utterly to God, still calls on Christ when there is a need. In fact, she's audacious about calling on him. At the wedding at Cana, Christ seems to be, in the text, quite reluctant to get involved. And Mary comes to him and brings him one of those earth-shattering dilemmas of the world, they've run out of wine. In a modern context, and now they've drunk quite a lot of wine before we get to this point, right? In the modern context, it would be like us standing there and say, somebody says, we're halfway through the barbecue, we've all had three beers. And it was, you know, they'd drunk quite a lot of wine, so they'd all had three beers. We've run out of beer. Right, let's hold a prayer meeting. We're going to pray for more beer. It seems trivial. It almost seems a little bit naughty to kind of ask for something so trivial. But Mary, not even the smallest detail frightens her. She comes straight to Christ and says, they've run out of wine. He says, I mean, Christ, there's lots of different interpretations of what he says, but he seems to be gently testing her on this one. He says, it's not my time yet. And yet, she simply completely, like most mothers, has a deaf ear to some particular things and says to the servants, do whatever he tells you, and then so on. I know some Catholics who would find such a request these days a little bit cheeky or perhaps even a little bit irreverent to ask God for something so trivial. And yet, do you think God thinks less of a child because they ask for something like a toy for Christmas? Or when we lay our smallest and most trivial request before God, we are simply acknowledging the intimacy of that relationship. Mary can ask Christ for wine precisely because she has that intimacy with him. She's his mother. Their common everyday conversations revolved around such small, trivial things. And no detail, this should reassure us about Mary's attention to our requests, no detail is too small for her. No detail. So in her leading the way, if you like, in terms of womanhood, no detail is too small in her care for people. Remember, this wasn't that they had no wine, but they've run out of wine. It would have been embarrassing for the host, but Mary wasn't the host. She was concerned for her host. It should have been the other way around. The host should have been concerned for her. She was concerned. And what's interesting is she wants to keep the party rolling. They are celebrating marriage, which is a wonderful, beautiful thing, but the celebration itself has now a tinge of godliness. We can now genuinely celebrate good things, baptisms, marriages, wonderful things, birthdays even, anniversaries, with joy and maybe a little extravagance. We join with Mary in doing that. Mary, we just mentioned that Mary commands the people to obey Christ. This is the point of, this is one of the key ways in which Mary leads us in both womanhood and in general Christianity. Her few words, let God do with me as he wishes, as you have said, and specifically, do whatever he tells you. These things could be the summary of all wisdom. When you look at the perfect wife described in Proverbs, the law of God, the teaching of God is on her tongue. She leads her children. She leads people around her. The poor, she gives good things. She leads people to Christ, to God. And Mary specifically doesn't try and go out and do something on her own, brings Christ immediately into it. She leads women in making Christ not only the center of their own personal spiritual life, but in the center of everything she does with and for other people. Her first point of call is to bring Christ into it and then act in accordance with that. Young women, always seek to bring Christ into your everyday relationships, the ordinary boring stuff. If you happen to be on dishes, do you wash dishes here, this thing? If you happen to be cleaning up, if you happen to be doing the ordinary boring stuff, bring Christ into it. Perhaps wordlessly, maybe if there's a word to say. The final point I wanted to bring about this is that at the foot of the cross, Mary was given to the disciple Jesus loved, and he was given to her. Mary was given to him as his mother, and he to her as his son. Mary is our mother. We often use the word mother about Mary without thinking about it terribly much. Mother, however, is the person we run to when we're little, the person who comforts us, the person who cries with us over those small hurts. If any of you have seen The Passion, you've seen the movie The Passion, you see that beautiful play when Christ falls with the cross and Mary has the flashback when he fell as a little boy and skinned his knee and she picks him up. That's just a perfect image of Marian motherhood, that she was at the foot of the cross, but she had been at the foot, so to speak, all the way through his life. And when her motherhood is passed on to us, I mean, how much more precious a gift, apart from himself, could Christ give us than his own mother? The perfect mother, in fact. This means, if women are going to imitate Mary's motherhood, that they take that self-sacrificial motherhood. What was the prophecy Simeon said in the temple about Mary? A sword will pierce your soul also. To love people, ladies, means to cop a sword. It hurts to love. It costs to love. When we love and they hurt, we hurt. Mary leads in that way. She never flinched once. The disciples ran. She was at the foot of the cross. The disciples didn't understand, but Mary understood from the very beginning with her songs and praise. We need people following in Mary's footsteps because we need people following in the footsteps of Christ, giving up their total womanhood. And obviously, gentlemen, there's many lessons for us, but for today, let's focus on the womanhood thing. We need Mary-like ladies. Now, that doesn't mean demure, completely repressed Christians, as they like to make out that Catholics are. Mary was the only one in that whole first chapter of Luke who dared to speak back to the angel, except Zechariah, who got himself in trouble. But Zechariah was terrified. Mary was unafraid. She engaged her intellect. She engaged herself observing what the needs were at Cana. She was intelligent, involved, engaged. And just if I can say a side point here, when we talk about Mary's submission, she models something that we'd like to say about submission in general. Submission is not simply relinquishing anything I might say or do or contribute. Submission is not cowering in the corner while someone else makes all the decisions. My wife submits to me every day. In fact, she usually submits a list. And she keeps submitting the list until it's done. She submits it because part of our love is to submit our needs to each other. That's what submission is. I need her to tell me what she needs because then it makes it so much easier for me to love her. And when we submit to Christ, we tell him what we need. When we submit to other people, it's not relinquishing our free will, it's engaging our free will. It's not relinquishing our intellect or our decision making, it's actually contributing that to what we're doing. I'm very glad to say that I have the benefit of a very intelligent, engaged, and willful woman who constantly enhances our relationship by submitting it completely and utterly, and repetitively, if I don't get the hint, in that way. So please concentrate on Mary as the example, the audacious, gentle, persistent Mary. It's time to move on to St. Joseph. St. Joseph is many things. I'm going to have to move fairly quickly. But one of the first is that Joseph is a guardian. Even before he marries Mary, he's already betrothed to her in a technical sense. So they're expecting, or at least he's the one she's reserved for. Although, by the way, had they been about to get married, as some people like to say, Why would Mary say, how am I going to have a baby? So it seems as if the arrangement was much more distant, as in either she was waiting for a much later time, or there was some other arrangement that he was her protector in that society while she was a perpetual virgin. We don't know. But Joseph was her guardian at that point. He was responsible for her, and then she turns up pregnant. Now imagine you are engaged to somebody and they turn up pregnant. Okay? What would your disposition to them be at that point? How would you feel about them right at that point? You're engaged to them and they turn up pregnant. Now Joseph has a lot of options available to him, mostly involving Mary being killed. The Jewish law quite specifically says that if he wasn't the one to make her pregnant, and he knows that, and she turns up pregnant, then he has to, in order to redeem his good name, he has to denounce her publicly, and then all these options list out, death by stoning or possibly other types of death, banishment at the very least. And yet, it's interesting, the scriptures say Joseph was a righteous man. Now, normally we think that's associated with the law and doing a letter of the law. He chooses the least damaging response to her. He makes up his mind to divorce her quietly, to release her, in fact, from the bond with him, quietly, so there's no shame, no damage to her. Remember, at this point, he has no reason to believe otherwise that she's cheated, because she's turned up pregnant. Normally, you know, there's been no virgin births up to this point. He normally wouldn't expect this to happen, and so he has to assume something's gone on that wasn't supposed to happen. And yet he chooses, in that moment of betrayal that he feels, he chooses the least damaging thing for his spouse. He chooses to protect her with everything that's within his power, within the law. Gentlemen, this is your first example. When he was most hurt and betrayed, he chose the least harmful thing for others. What's our reaction as guys when we get hurt? It's to lash out, isn't it? To hurt. Joseph chose the most gentle, protective way. Joseph is chosen as the guardian to the divine family. Pope after pope comes out with this. Joseph was the guardian of the divine family. What happens when Herod tries to kill Christ? They're out of there. They go to Egypt. And notice Joseph doesn't put his dukes up and go looking for a fight, because most of the time fighting is actually about my ego and my status. Joseph simply goes to Egypt. Job done. Family safe. He comes back when it's safe again. The church holds up the example of Joseph as the exemplar of fathers and men, workers too. He's the model of fatherhood and masculinity, said Benedict, citing a whole list of popes, who by his life teaches us the meaning of our own fatherhood. Joseph used his fatherly authority, the authority of a father, to give himself completely to the care of his spouse. Do we hear anything about Joseph except for what he does for Jesus or Mary? The only time we hear about him is when he's done something or been doing something for Jesus and Mary. And this one always gets people, especially people who aren't Catholics, really agitated. Mary remained a virgin all her life. And as one young spark said in a classroom to me once when I spoke, he said, well, why did he get married? What was in it for him? Apart from the perfect wife, this is the point. Nobody could accuse Joseph of being in it for himself. Because in worldly terms, what did he get out of it, so to speak? He had a wife who never slept with him and a son who was nothing but trouble. And worse, he still had to take the blame for everything. St. Joseph gives everything he has to his family. The third big thing the popes bring out is that Joseph is the exemplar, the example of simple virtue. What do they mean by that? They don't mean he wasn't smart. They mean that Joseph is not a superhero. He doesn't have a secret cape locked away somewhere. He's no He doesn't have amazing superpowers. He can't bilocate. He can't do all the other cool things that saints have been known to do. Joseph is just a guy who was a carpenter. And yet he's still one of the most prominent and revered male saints. What for? Precisely because he took his very ordinary skills, his very ordinary self, and he put it all at the service of Christ. Every single ounce of his strength. Joseph is the most revered, not because he was extraordinary, but because he took everything about himself, every ordinary thing, and put it at the service of Christ. He is proof that the followers of Christ need only have, says Benedict, common, simple, human virtues which are available to everyone. He's the exemplar of human fatherhood, and his fatherhood is expressed in terms of a life given to his wife and to the child born to her. Joseph exercises his fatherly authority in a way that mirrors God's fatherly authority. He protects. He teaches. His obedience is the model of, it's the basis of his authority. So in other words, as Christ said, the centurion said to Christ, I am a man under authority, therefore I understand authority. Joseph is under God's authority. When he's about to divorce Mary, the angel says, do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife. And he takes her as his wife. Now, he can only do so, and he only does so, because she's a gift from God. Probably the fourth lesson by now, gentlemen. Your wife or anybody in your life, in fact, parents, siblings, friends, are a gift from God. They're to be treated with the same reverence as if God himself handed them to you wrapped and ready. Just a quote directly from a pope. Do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife becomes the admonition to young men and old everywhere. Don't be afraid to take up the heroic challenge of being a husband and of manhood in general. I'm going to come back to courage as the last thing. Well, second last. Very briefly, I want to note that how many things in Scripture do we have that Joseph said? Not a word. How do we even know anything about him to call him a saint? His actions did his talking. Next lesson, gentlemen. Don't talk big, act big. Let your actions do the talking. You shouldn't ever have to tell a girl how great you are. She should be able to see it in what you've done and what you're doing. Just as a brief aside, my son recently asked me if he could call up a girl. And I said, well, why? You get to ask stupid questions when you're a father. And he said, well, I want to practice. I want to get better at talking to girls. And I said, well, excellent. What if I come up with the foolproof plan that's worked throughout history that makes young men better at talking to girls and makes girls actually like young men better? He says, that sounds good. I'll go with that. So, the very first thing you do is learn to respect your heavenly mother, Mary, pray the rosary. The second thing you do is learn to respect and revere and treat your mother with respect. And the third thing you do is treat your sisters with respect. And when you've got that down, come back to me and we'll talk about the other girl. And ladies, wouldn't you agree, if you see a guy who knows how to treat his mother and his sisters with respect, you know he's not just putting it on for you. He's actually, you know, it's a normal part of his way that he sees as a normal way that he treats ladies. And it should be that way. Gentlemen, start with your heavenly mother. Start with the rosary. And that teaches you some of the respect in revering the perfect Mary. Then your own mother, however flawed she may be. And then your sisters, however additionally flawed they are. And then you might be ready, to approach another young lady and be worthy of her. Perhaps. Joseph speaks through his actions. His actions are not grandiose. They're not huge. They are just simple, ordinary protection, care, sustenance, caring. Now, imagine the daily heroism of a man who knows he's never going to get anything out of a relationship and yet constantly provides for these people and constantly provides unflinching love and care. Benedict says, and John Paul before him, that Mary's purity, Mary's virginity, is only possible in a world where Joseph's overarching protection completely keeps her safe. It's never challenged. Her reputation is unchallenged because Joseph takes the hit. Joseph takes the hit. If anyone thought ill of Mary for getting pregnant too early, they would have blamed it on Joseph because they assumed, he took the hit in reputation. He took the hit in terms of his career. He leaves his whole career to take Jesus and Mary away. Who's in danger from Herod? Only small children. Joseph himself, perhaps even Mary, are safe, but he leaves everything to get Mary safe. He's spurred into action by circumstances. Real men don't need to go looking for heroism. They deal with what the circumstances that present themselves. They deal with what's going on in everyday life. Our heroism, gentlemen, is likely to be boring. The things that are actually very hard to do as Christians are boring. I was ready when I first got married to take a bullet for my wife. I wasn't ready within the first week of being married to get up early and do the dishes for her. The bullet we take, the hard things in life, are the ones that no one's ever going to know, the ones that even our wife will never know, the little things we do just for them, the gifts. Joseph is courageous. This is the one I want to emphasize as the final point. Joseph is courageous. It is courage to take on Mary as his wife. Yes, objectively speaking, we know she's the most amazing woman ever to live. And yet, Joseph, in his situation, is dealing with a woman who's pregnant outside of their own relationship. That's not a normal situation. There are some of the fathers that actually say, perhaps Joseph thought to divorce her quietly because he thought he wasn't worthy of her. That he wasn't, good enough to be the father of this amazing Saviour. But the angel says, don't be afraid to take Mary as your bride. And as Benedict says, this is an echo for all men. Don't be afraid to take up manhood. For this audience, I'll add this. There is a common complaint that it's hard to figure out the rules of dating. Now, it hasn't bothered me for 20 years or so, so I'm not really the one to talk with authority on it, but, gentlemen, what's the danger of asking a girl out? What's the danger? Can someone... that she might subject you? And ladies would have the same danger, wouldn't they, if they were going to ask? So if, gentlemen, you are looking to enter into a relationship where you would be the strong, the protector, the one who would take the hit, how are you going to face her if you didn't take that first risk? If one of you is going to take a risk, let it be you. Now, on the other side, ladies, if someone actually does take a risk and ask and you're saying no, do it graciously. Do it in such a way as to encourage them to keep trying. not with you, but do it graciously. There's nothing more damaging than a fellow who steps out the first time and makes an effort and then gets squashed. But gentlemen, that's the risk. And you, if you are not prepared to take that risk because you're worried about your ego in a small way, then you're not ready to step up to a relationship. Stop right there. When you're ready to take that risk for this girl in that very first step, then you're ready to take the first step at least. Courage starts at the very beginning. Also, courage says, and the genuine example of Joseph says, I will treat this woman and every other woman I meet that God puts in my way with the same dignity and respect and reverence, regardless of what I get in return. It has to be that. If, gentlemen, you base your respect and dignity, respect and honor for a woman based on what you get in return in terms of friendship, relationship, whatever, your marriages will fail. Because there are always going to be times when you don't feel that respect or you don't get anything in return. You must be determined to do as Joseph did and give everything you've got with no kickbacks. That is why he's revered. That's why he's the exemplar of workers. One last thing. Joseph gives us the perfect example of how work and prayer, work and spirituality mixes. We often think of, I work, I go to church, I pray separately. All these things are compartmentalized. Joseph is the one, says so the three of the recent popes, where prayer and work come together. That his silent, constant reverence, his righteousness in his work, his dedication to his wife and to his son, show us how we can work prayerfully so that everything we do is actually an offering to Christ. Everything we do is part of this gift. Mary and Joseph are quite intimidating because they are fairly good at what they did. However, just remember that neither Mary nor Joseph had any of these extraordinary gifts that you see in terms of human gifts. We don't hear of Mary being a stunning supermodel. We don't hear of her being amazing at anything in particular, except that God has graced her. And that she completely commits herself, mind, body, and soul, to God and his plan. We don't hear about Joseph being amazing, even as a carpenter. We just hear that he was one. And yet he gives everything he is and has to God and to his son. There's no excuses in this respect, but there's also no lack of hope. No matter how we feel about our lives now, about how the risks are, how worthy we are, these two people give us a perfect example of manhood and womanhood in a world that's forgotten what they are. As you go through, don't forget that there's a reason. We're looking at the popes and coming back to, if you like, the continuation, I hope, of the various messages the popes give us through the last couple of popes. It was very hard to isolate Benedict, John Paul II, and to some extent Francis from all the other popes, because every single pope that I read had said something about these two. Why? Because it comes back to the ordinary details of our Christian life. Keep looking for that in them. Don't forget that the Hail Mary is looking at Christ through Mary's eyes. We're participating in that ordinary, genuine, daily, if you like, care that she had for him, but also seeing the greatness and the majesty of God in him. Gentlemen, in addition to having a reverence to Mary in the rosary, focus also on a devotion to St. Joseph, I would say. Keep in mind that simple, humble, not speaking but acting example of Christian manhood. And with that, I'll finish.
You have been listening to a talk by Peter Holmes. Eyewitness was held at Stanmore Tops, New South Wales, in December 2013. The theme for the conference this year was Benedict and Beyond. And for more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.